The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
It's very fundamental to our democracy that the president is elected by the people and has the power and authority to control the executive branch. On the other hand, there are norms that have grown up around that authority that should limit it.
I'm David Chris.
And I'm Nate Jones. And this is the Culper Partners Rule of Law special series on the Lawfare podcast.
In this podcast series, we explore the rule of law, particularly as it relates to U.S. national security and criminal law enforcement.
Our guest today is Jamie Gorelick. Jamie has had a career spanning the legal, policy, and corporate worlds, in and out of government. Currently a partner at WilmerHale, she has represented corporations and individuals in a wide array of matters, particularly in the regulatory and enforcement arenas. In government, she was one of the longest-serving deputy attorneys general of the United States. Prior to that, she was the general counsel at the Department of Defense. She serves and has served on numerous government boards and commissions, including the Defense Policy Board, and she was a member of the 9/11 Commission.
So in this episode, we get the benefit of Jamie's years of experience as a lawyer in government in the private sector. She talks about the shame of current attacks on the rule of law and prosecutorial independence. She gives us the benefit of her self-described hawkish views on when it's appropriate for the news media to publish classified information. And she describes a time that she was involved in a major dispute involving whether and to what extent the FBI should brief the White House on efforts by a foreign government to influence U.S. elections. That time, of course, being the 1990s, and the country in question being China. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 415, Jamie Gorelick on the Rule of Law. So, you worked at the Justice Department. Why is it important for DOJ to be free from political interference?
It's important in a democracy and in our constitutional system for people to have confidence that justice is being applied in an even-handed and fair way. And when there is political influence, or if there were to be political influence on enforcement decisions, people would lose that faith in the system.
And what actually happens, what follows from repeated challenges to the impartiality and integrity of prosecutors and agents in the system?
You could imagine that the system would just break down. A great deal of the way in which the system works is that people have confidence in its fairness. And so when a representation is made by a prosecutor or an investigator, you can ordinarily have confidence in it. As a defense lawyer, you would say to your client, this is how the system works. This is why it is fair. This is why you should have a confidence in its fairness. And the system would then allow that client to feel that the work of the department is proceeding in a fair way. No one likes to be the object or subject of an enforcement, but if every person facing such a proceeding needed to challenge or felt they needed to challenge every single decision, the system would break down. It would fall of its own weight.
And I guess that confidence in the integrity and fairness of the system is important to a defense lawyer's client, whether that client be a street sweeper or the president of the United States, just to take a hypothetical example. It has to apply at all levels, right?
Yes. I mean, it's important to defendants, defense lawyers, and to the citizenry generally. I mean, we live in a fairly skeptical age, to say the least, and people are already inclined not to believe in their institutions. If people don't believe in our judiciary and don't believe in our law enforcement agencies, we are in a world of hurt.
So one of the situations that the system has to accommodate is a situation in which the investigative agencies are looking not outward but inward and even up the chain to people in positions of power within the investigative hierarchy. So one of the ways obviously we deal with that is with what we now call a special counsel. What are the reasons exactly for appointing a special counsel? Why are they important to the rule of law and the integrity of the system?
As we just discussed, it's awfully important for people who are the subject of an investigation and also the general public to have confidence that the rule of law exists for everyone, that the system of justice is fair. And if for any reason people are given to question that fairness, that's very destructive of our democracy. And for that reason, we have often had the ability within the Justice Department to appoint someone who is outside of the system when it could be credibly argued that the people inside the system could be prejudiced in some way. That special counsel law or regulation has taken various different forms. The current form is an appointee, the special counsel is an appointee of the department, as opposed to, for example, the courts. But in each case, the special counsel has that characteristic. He or she is appointed from outside the normal chain.
One way that the independence and integrity of the system can be called into question is through people's actions, but another one is through words. And I'm wondering if you have a reaction to some of the rhetoric that we've seen deployed publicly by political leaders in the country right now, calling into question the integrity. And is that something you're concerned about? Do you think it can have as equally a destructive effect?
Well, it's a shame. Honestly, if senior governmental officials call into question the fairness of a proceeding, or they say something which is either designed to or would have the effect of undermining the fairness of the proceeding, it just increases the challenge to the system which is designed to be and appear to be fair. In the military context, it's called command influence. When a senior commander says something or does something that puts a thumb on the scale, in civilian contexts, while it's not completely analogous, the possibility of prejudgment by a senior and influential government figure is disruptive of the confidence we want to have in the system of justice.
Yeah, and you know, we have a system where, as you've talked about, the law enforcement components of our government are supposed to remain independent and free from political influence, but at the same time, they're supposed to fit within a system of checks and balances, right? And you want to have a certain level of accountability to make sure that they are staying within their lanes and adhering to these principles. And, you know, one of the sort of unique things is that despite the desire for independence, they're headed by political appointees. And, you know, why is that?
Why, you're asking, why is it, for example, that the Department of Justice is headed by a political appointee?
Yeah, who serves at the pleasure of the president and for example, can be removed at any time by the president.
Well, there are many decisions that one makes. For example, many decisions that I made as Deputy Attorney General or that my boss, the Attorney General, made that are policy decisions that should be made consistent with the policy goals of the president, assuming that they are lawful. So it is perfectly sensible for the Justice Department to have political appointees in the senior positions. Having said that, we've had a long tradition of ensuring, or at least attempting to ensure, that there is no political influence in a law enforcement context. The Justice Department, in that respect, is unique among all of the executive branch agencies because it has both investigators and prosecutors. And it has been, until quite recently, the considered view of everyone that those functions, those enforcement functions, should not be the subject of political influence or control.
Yeah. And, you know, so we have a system where the leadership is purposefully designed to be political, where you create some level of accountability for their actions and their overall performance. But I'm wondering, how do you draw those distinctions in the day-to-day work of the department? Is it always clear? Are those rules that keep politics out of individual matters clearly written down somewhere? Are they enforceable? Are they well understood within the workforce?
Well, I would first say that there are some ambiguities, and one has to draw lines. So, for example, you might say, as president, I think it's very important to prosecute drug cases. That would be totally appropriate to say that's how I want to allocate my resources in the Department of Justice. That's the emphasis I want to have. It would be improper to say, I want to bring a drug case against you, against an individual. That would be interfering with the proper function of the Justice Department to evaluate the facts and law of a case and determine whether a case should be brought. So that's one area where one draws some lines, but I think sophisticated people who've been in those jobs know the difference between the two examples I just gave. Yeah. In the national security arena, there are also some gray areas where the Department of Justice has national security functions. Sometimes those national security functions also are law enforcement functions. And disaggregating the two is very important. I was involved in a very significant dispute with our FBI, who at the time refused to brief the White House and the National Security Council on a Chinese attempt to affect our elections, because the FBI felt that there were people in the White House, including the president, who might be involved in such a scheme. That turned out to be entirely untrue. But in the meantime, they refused to allow what would have been a normal briefing of the Secretary of State as she was heading to China to negotiate something with the Chinese, where she really did have a need to know that information in the national security and foreign policy interests of the United States. So there are instances when there are, you know, hard questions that need to be addressed, and they need to be addressed by people with common assumptions about the proper role of the Justice Department and its law enforcement function.
Hey, Jamie, so this Chinese election interference case that you dealt with, where they thought the White House might be in some way involved in the interference, that was when you were deputy back in the 90s? Or is that...
Yeah.
Okay.
That was when I was deputy in the 1990s. You don't have to sound quite so surprised, Mr. Chris.
I wasn't sure if you were speaking of more recent events as opposed to events from back when you were in government. That's an interesting, you know, point of comparison to present day. That's all. So let me ask this. We talked about sort of when it is proper, when it is improper for a president to sort of try to influence the prosecutive actions of the department at the policy level rather than at the case level. Let's look at it from the other direction. Let's say you're a high-ranking Justice Department official and you end up on the receiving end of what feels like improper direction, case-specific direction or politicized direction from the White House or from the president himself. What are you supposed to do? Do you resign? Do you protest? Do you go public? How are senior officials in the Justice Department supposed to think about it and react when they feel like they're on the wrong end of something like that?
Well, for one thing, you're supposed to be staunch. The way in which this policy, if you will, this practice, if you will, has taken form has been in a set of letters, usually between the White House counsel and the Attorney General or the Deputy Attorney General, and also a similar set of letters between senior Justice Department officials and the oversight committees of Congress, including especially the Senate Judiciary Committee, that basically lay out the principle, which is that one wants to keep politics out of the law enforcement and prosecutorial function. And in order to do that, communications between, for example, the White House and the Justice Department should go through the Attorney General or the Deputy. That way you don't have to lay out hard and fast rules. You are elevating any possible concern to the highest possible level, and that person at that very high level should be somebody of sufficient strength to say no when an inappropriate request is made.
Okay.
And, you know, I there were times when someone would say something to me thinking it would be a normal thing to say because that's how they would deal with another government agency.
Right.
And I would say that's really not something that we can accommodate or do. I never had a situation where anyone responded with other than, oh, really, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to say anything that was inappropriate. So I don't have an example for you of what I would, should someone have ordered me to do the thing that would have been contrary to the principles that we've been talking about. So, I can only speculate on what that might be. For the most part, people understood that there were important principles and that there was jeopardy to the Department of Justice and to the person on the other end of the phone if they did not get this right.
Yeah. Well, let's sort of bring it into the present day world. You know, caving in is not an option, but what do you think, what do you make of officials who are today remaining in the Trump administration? I think many of them, at least, on the theory that they are helping to rein in the president. I mean, how are they supposed to deal with the sort of very overt excesses that we have seen in Twitter and elsewhere? You know, at the extreme, is it okay to do what this anonymous senior administration official said that he or she is doing in that famous op-ed, which basically said, I'm going to undermine and subvert the president's will and carry out a proper Republican agenda? Is that okay? I mean, how are people supposed to square this circle?
I don't really know the answer to that. It's very fundamental to our democracy that the president is elected by the people and has the power and authority to control the executive branch. On the other hand, there are norms that have grown up around that authority that should limit it. And, the person presumes was not in the Justice Department. The Justice Department has incredible sensitivities that go well beyond those in other agencies where it's the policy direction that is in debate. Here, you know, the liberty of an individual could be an issue. So I don't know the answer to that, and I've never happily had to grapple with that. I've served in a number of Democratic administrations, and I've seen anything like that.
Yeah.
In terms of the career staff at the department, do you think that the political leaders must and should have prior experience as career DOJ lawyers or career government lawyers? Is coming up within that system and sort of learning these rules and regulations from the ground up an important part of carrying out your responsibilities, not just as a senior official, but to insulate and protect the people serving under you?
I need to know the department, but I don't think you need to have served there. Now, I say that in part because I knew the department very well, but had not served there when I became Deputy Attorney General. I would think it would be challenging to have neither the Deputy Attorney General nor the Attorney General, for example, to have criminal justice experience. In my case, my boss was a lifelong prosecutor and therefore knew very well what the obligation and norms were for her in carrying out her job. You know, there are a lot of things that a senior Justice Department official has to do that are not particularly advanced by coming up through the career ranks. One of the lovely things that coming up through those ranks does for you, if you've been trained correctly, is it beats every political instinct you might have had out of you. It also attracts people who don't have any and don't want any. And the fact of the matter is that a very senior position in the Department of Justice does require some political instincts. It requires understanding where other parts of the government are coming from and what might be motivating them and how to address their concerns. There are lots of government agencies that have issues that can only be addressed by the Department of Justice. It requires you to understand where Congress is coming from on particular issues and how to navigate for the department both authorizations and appropriations on the Hill. And I could give you many, many examples. So the best stewardship of the Department of Justice is found in a combination of skills. So I had not been a prosecutor, but I had very senior career prosecutors on my staff. And I made sure that I had the best of the best and that the people I had working for me were very highly regarded. Not all of them, to be sure. Indeed, you wouldn't want your entire staff to be current or former prosecutors, but I wanted a good chunk of my staff to have that, and I believe that that is really what is necessary. I would just say that bouquet, if you will, that collection of skills can be put together in lots of different ways. So you could have an attorney general who's not been a prosecutor and a deputy who has. You can supplement and complement skills by the senior staff that you hire. So I would not apply a hard and fast rule, but I would say you do want the different skill sets to be available to you.
Yeah, it's interesting. You talk about professional diversity. I'm wondering what your views are on other types of diversity at the department, both what things like gender, racial, ethnic diversity bring to the department generally, and how good a job the department has done on increasing diversity over the years.
You're making decisions at these levels that affect an awful lot of people in the country, pretty much everyone. And so you want to have sensitivity to how what you're doing will be viewed. And it's hard to have that. Your staff is monochrome.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, to take that one step further, if you have that monochrome perspective and you aren't fully appreciating the way your actions are going to impact different parts or different groups within the country, that can potentially subvert the public's trust in the department in the long run. So it circles back to the rule of law in that regard. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely, and it can be expressed in all kinds of ways. When I had really hard cases to decide, I looked for somebody who had been both a prosecutor and a defense lawyer, because I wanted to make sure that both of those perspectives were brought to bear in the decision making. When I had hard decisions to make, for example, when we were trying to address the bombings of black churches in the South, I wanted to understand how the different members of that community would understand and feel and see and appreciate our actions. So I made sure we had a diverse group of people working on that task force. I can give you lots of examples of that.
That's very interesting.
So back to political diversity, though, you said before, and as a alumni of the system, I can agree with you that as a career prosecutor, they will beat the political instincts out of you if you had any to begin with. But, you know, it is obviously the case that individual DOJ line attorneys and agents are going to have political views. So tell us a little more about how they're conditioned to set aside those views and why it's important that they do so, and why the expression of those views can be particularly pernicious. Even if they're held quietly, it's one thing, but if they're said out loud, it almost gets worse. Why is that?
I never knew what the politics were of the people, the career staff who were working underneath me, and I never asked, and I can't remember an instance in which it became apparent to me in the course of the conversation. It is just trained out of you. Having said that, we do not want to have a political litmus test for career people. That would be terrible. One of the reasons that the career prosecutors and career civil servants within the Department of Justice are as effective as they are in maintaining the traditions and norms of the department is that they are permitted to and encouraged to be there their whole lives, and they can have their own political views outside, but inside you just bring to bear the facts and the law in deciding a case. The best and most senior lawyers in the department have served under every kind of administration. And that's the way you want it. When a career person brings their politics to the fore, it undermines the notion that cases are being decided, decisions are being made on an apolitical, non-political basis, and it kind of tears at the fabric of the Department of Justice, which is just so important.
So this is a particular example, so don't feel you need to respond if you don't want to. But when Bob Mueller was confronted with the text messages between Pete Strzok and Lisa Page at the Bureau, it sounds like he didn't hesitate very long before sending Strzok packing. Do you think he got that right, or was there any way to sort of rehabilitate or make it okay?
I don't want to comment on a particular case.
Yeah, fair enough.
But given the microscope under which a special counsel operates in particular, there's probably less tolerance in that instance than there would be any place else.
Yeah.
And I would comment with respect to Bob Mueller. When I was deputy AG, here was somebody who had been at the most senior levels in the prior Republican administration. And I remember one day, David Margolis, who was absolutely famous and wonderful senior prosecutor within the department, who was on my staff, but had also served ably in Republican and Democratic administrations, came into my office and he said, would it be okay with you if Bob Mueller returned to the department trying murder cases in the District of Columbia in the U.S. Attorney's Office in D.C. And I said, who would turn down, you know, Bob Mueller if he wants to try murder cases?
Right.
I knew that he would not bring his politics to bear in the U.S. Attorney's Office. There was no way I was going to say he shouldn't return to the department, which he clearly loved and had served well. And there are lots of examples of that, not quite as famous as Bob Mueller, where people have served in political positions, but really in their hearts are career attorneys.
You know, I was just thinking of David Margolis, and I'm sure you recall the org chart that he had up on his wall It was, I think, entitled Bob Mueller's Biggest Nightmare. And then every box within the criminal division had the name David Margolis in it. So he used to...
Yes, well, he had the... David Margolis had the temerity to refer to Bob Mueller as Bobby Three Sticks.
Bobby Three Sticks.
Another source of accountability for the Department of Justice and law enforcement more generally is congressional oversight, obviously. In your mind, does that raise some of the similar concerns about political influence and pressure on the department?
Yes. And I had numerous interactions with members of Congress around those issues. I often had to say no to requests for information when a committee or an individual member of Congress wanted information about an ongoing criminal investigation. The right answer to that is we don't do that. It does undermine the ability to function if you are a prosecutor or an investigator, if somebody is revealing information that you know and that you need to use in your investigation. It is likewise a problem if Congress tries to put a thumb on the scale on an enforcement matter by holding a hearing that probes a matter that is under current investigation. I once had a very hard conversation with a very senior member of who wanted to hold a hearing on something that was really troubling him, but it was also during the pendency of a criminal investigation of that very man. And he said, you know, you can't tell me what I can investigate. I said, no, I can't tell you what you can investigate, but I can tell you if you investigate, I'm not going to be able to prosecute, and you're going to have to take responsibility for that.
And in your experience, is that a common trade-off? I mean, you know, just thinking about what's happening now, where you have an ongoing, among other things, criminal investigation into election interference, and you have both in the House and the Senate ongoing congressional investigations. And I'm just wondering, are there ways to thread that needle where Congress can get the information it needs and do the work it needs to do to ensure its legislative activities are well informed, or is this an intractable problem that you run into inevitably?
Well, all I can say is that one could do this, but you have to do it very carefully, and each case is different. There are some instances in which there are no public policy issues and in which the member of Congress simply has a constituent interest, for example. And it's easy to say you really can't be trying to affect our decision making here. Where there is a major public policy issue that is running in parallel to an enforcement matter, it's a tougher case. But I still think that the department has to be staunch in saying we are going to look to see whether any question you are asking can undermine a pending criminal matter. And if so, we are going to be extremely reluctant to give you what you want. And then you have to get down dirty and understand what their needs are and what the needs of justice are.
Right. Yeah. You know, one of the things that David and I talk about a lot these days is that historically that approach has worked fairly well where you have, you know, an understanding Congress and you have senior folks in the executive branch and at the White House who are willing to back DOJ up on holding firm on some of those red lines and making sure that members of Congress understand why they're important. And in the last couple of years, we've seen a somewhat strange situation where folks at the White House and in the executive branch at senior levels have almost been unusually willing to turn over some of this information. I'm thinking specifically of in the context of Chairman Nunes and the House Intelligence Committee investigation, where they think certain facts, even about ongoing investigations, might help rehabilitate their public image. And I'm wondering, you know, I assume that that is not a situation you confronted in your time at the department or another government service. But I'm wondering if you have a reaction, not to necessarily the specifics of any of those cases, but just to the general question about whether or not the system can really withstand an executive branch in Congress at the political level who seem to be in cahoots.
I mean, it's an absolutely unheard of situation where the White House, which should be backing the Justice Department so that it can do its job, could have an interest in the Justice Department not doing its job. You know, it defies all of the norms that we've been talking about. So clearly, I never experienced anything like that. And I would say that, you know, during my tenure at Justice, there were very senior people in the administration who had matters of enforcement matters pending at the Department of Justice. I am very certain that the president would have liked to have been helpful to those people because they were serving in senior positions in his administration, and he never did anything remotely like that to put a thumb on the scale or subvert or try to subvert our processes. So we haven't had exactly this circumstance, but in many administrations we've had something close to it, and you just don't see the department not have the backing of the president. Most presidents really do understand the importance of justice and the rule of law.
So if that's the case, do you have the sense, first from the public record as you've seen it, that maybe DOJ has caved in too far and acceded too much to these congressional demands? And for the long run, do you have a sense we're going to bounce back from this, or is there more lasting damage that's been done here?
I don't know enough about the particulars to have a firm view on that question, David. I know that many people who are veterans of the department have been very worried that the sharing of information underlying a criminal investigation with Congress has gone way too far. The problem with this question is that it is one of norms. You can find many instances in which senior Justice Department officials have said no in the circumstances. Getting back to the norm is hard. I hope it isn't a one-way. I hope that we can get back to the norms and that people who revere the department and those norms will help that happen.
When we were talking about interactions between DOJ and the White House and the politicization of law enforcement, you mentioned the sort of increasing coexistence of law enforcement and national security. And I want to sort of play that out a little bit on the congressional side now. You know, obviously, that Congress is to be kept by statute fully and currently informed of intelligence activities. And now, sort of with the FISA wall down and this closer coexistence between national security matters and criminal matters, how do you think, if at all, the norms of disclosure of an ongoing criminal case that might have national security implications, you know, have evolved? Should there be an evolution, or does the change of increasing coexistence not really affect the standards for briefing Congress?
I think each of these facts needs to, or factual patterns needs to be evaluated on its own, and that means looking at the importance of the congressional role, whether one can acquit that or allow that responsibility to be acquitted without truly undermining an investigation. So, you know, if you're smart about it and thoughtful about it, for the most part, you should be able to make many of these conflicts go away. And I'll go back to the situation that I described earlier with the investigation of Chinese influence in our elections. I said to the FBI and the criminal division, I want you to write out for me something that you could say to our national security leaders to inform them of this Chinese effort that will not in any way affect the criminal investigation that you will run. And they did.
Yeah.
And I thought we had a, you know, kind of a good outcome. It wasn't much, but it was enough to alert a Madeleine Albright or a national security advisor as to what was happening without undermining in any way in the criminal case. And in that instance, the director of the FBI said, I don't think, even with this, I don't think any communication should take place. And the issue went to the attorney general, and I think she felt that she had to back him. And I still think I was right. I'm convinced that I was right.
Yep.
So I do think for the most part, one can navigate this. There are probably some situations which one can't, but I don't think it's amenable to a black and white rule.
Right. You served on the 9/11 Commission, which has been sort of held up by many as a shining example of bipartisanship or maybe even nonpartisanship. In, you know, looking retroactively at a pretty significant crisis and trying to chart a path forward. And I'm wondering, in light of all of the, you know, heavy partisanship that's been seemingly infecting DC, do you have a hope that we can return to a time where there's more bipartisanship, more people reaching across the aisle to try to solve these problems, or are we on a downward spiral that we can't get out of?
Well, there were some very special circumstances. First, I would say that, you know, initially the Bush administration was not willing to charter a commission,
mm-hmm.
and it asked that there be a special congressional panel, which in the end kind of fell on its own weight.
Yeah.
So while the 9/11 Commission is a good example of bipartisanship, it wasn't wholly embraced by the then sitting administration. So that's one observation I'd make. The second is that the event of 9/11 was so searing to the country that the population as a whole wanted to know what went wrong and how do we prevent it from happening again. So it was very strong citizen support for having an inquiry. And third, I would say that the victims' families advocated for it, and they were very sympathetic.
Yeah.
And they had a moral stance that was hard for people to object to. And so they not only help create the commission, but they protected it at every stage in which we came up against the roadblock. And finally, I would say that the composition of the commission helped it arrive at a 100% bipartisan set of factual conclusions and policy recommendations. And those structures were, even though we were 10 people appointed by the most partisan folks in town, the White House, both houses of Congress, both parties, we were not in office anymore, unlike members of Congress who are constantly having to run for office. And so we had the freedom, actually, to do what we were appointed to do, and we were led by two very, very able and very staunch people. So I'm not saying this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to have a unanimous report on a tough set of issues. But it's very difficult for sitting members of Congress to do this because everything in their lives is anchored in politics, and that was not true for us.
Yeah. Let me ask you another question. You know, one of the common themes that we've heard throughout the course of the conversations we've been having with folks is the rule of law is really important. It is under duress at the moment, and it's heavily dependent on people to preserve and protect. And I guess one of the things I'm wondering is, you know, as we look at some of the places these threats are coming from, they're in some cases coming from non-lawyers or people who have not served in government previously. And I'm wondering if part of the problem here is that we, as former government officials and as a profession of lawyers, have failed to communicate these things as effectively as we need to future generations. Is that a problem in your estimation?
It may well be. You know, when, as David knows well, after Jim Comey gave his famous press conference, I co-authored with another one of my predecessors on the other side of the aisle a piece with some very good help from Mr. Crist that did try to teach. It said that that set of actions taken by Comey arrogated to himself authority that he did not have, which presented a threat to our democracy. Those kinds of editorials, that kind of teaching, it really needs to be done. I don't know, there was a petition that followed soon thereafter in which thousands of, I think it was thousands, a lot of former prosecutors said this was completely improper on Comey's part. So, you know, I think each of us has to do our part. But it's not obvious, right? It is not obvious that the Department of Justice is any different from the Department of Energy or the Department of the Interior. It's not obvious to a person who's not served there or who hasn't studied it. It is just another piece of the civics that we are not teaching people. And I think a lot of what is wrong with our country now can be traced to the fact that we have constitutional illiteracy.
Yeah. All right, well, let's take a look at another part of American life that's been in the news lately and serves an educational function, perhaps, and that's the news media. Does the news media play an important role in educating the citizenry and checking the government as well? And can you just explain a little bit about how?
Well, if you're a government official and you have the news media checking what you're doing and checking what you're saying, it's very healthy. I mean, I didn't like it when I was criticized, right. But I did think it was a healthy process. So I have tremendous respect for the press and journalists. What's happened with the press has made it much more challenging for it to play the role that it used to play, because we used to have a set of facts to a degree that we do not have now, because you can listen to, watch, read just the facts you want to hear, and that makes it very difficult to have a consensus as to what course should be taken.
Yeah. Well, what about publishing classified information that comes from a leaker? That happens an awful lot. There seems to be a trend over the last several years towards more and more publication. What do you think the standards and the rules are for when, if ever, the media ought to publish classified information?
I'm a hawk on these issues. I've seen too many harms come from too many leaks, real harms. And often the member of the press who has a bit of leaked information doesn't appreciate what those harms are. You know, I know there are people who think that Snowden was a hero. I think his leaking, his, in essence, publication of classified information has done tremendous harm to our national security. I'm sure there are lots of people who disagree with that, but that's my view.
And, you know, would you go so far as to consider in any case, even an extreme case, actually prosecuting a publishing entity, whether it be WikiLeaks on the one extreme, maybe, or, say, the New York Times at the other end of the spectrum? What's your thinking on that score?
We had a very strong policy when I was at the Justice Department. We had a head of public affairs, Carl Stern, who was a very highly regarded journalist for his entire career before he came to justice. And when there was any question about seeking information from a journalist or a news outlet, let alone prosecuting one, he had a seat at the table and he was an able advocate for the press. And we built that tension into our decision making, and I think that that was the right thing to do. I would be very loath to prosecute or even investigate a journalist. Now, defining what a journalist is a whole other question. I don't consider WikiLeaks to be journalism.
Yeah. What about, like, the lone blogger now who lives in his mom's basement? You know, this is not President Trump's 400-pound guy, but, like, you know, some kid who's got access to the internet and in that sense is maybe publishing. Or perhaps two former government officials who have a tiny little podcast. Surely they should be protected from any investigation.
Yeah, I mean, you get these salami slices along the way from WikiLeaks to the New York Times that you just have to review. But clearly, you know, legitimate journalism deserves more protection than a thief who goes and takes something and publishes it on a blog or otherwise.
All right. And that actually seems like a very good place to leave it. So, Jamie Gorelick, thank you very much for joining us on the Rule of Law podcast.
Happy to do so. Good to talk with you.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Jamie Gorelick for coming on the show. If you haven't yet, please take a second to share the Lawfare podcast on social media and give us a 5-star rating and review wherever you found us. You can also now purchase Lawfare swag at our online store, www.thelawfarestore.com. The podcast is edited by Jen Patya Howell, and our music is performed by Sophia Yam. As always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.